Cash Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be talking about a bunch of new movies. The big one, one of my most anticipated movies of the summer, Guardians of the Galaxy, is out, so we'll be talking about that and what I think it might do at the box office. Also, get on up, wow, the James Brown biopic. There's also I, Origins, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Life Itself, which I finally had a chance to see with all my travels. I'm a little behind on that, but this is, of course, the Roger Ebert documentary. And I'm also going to be talking a little bit more about Boyhood, not necessarily a review as much as, well, more on that later. So you'll have to stick around for sort of like a little bit of a look of inside baseball, the way movie promotion works. There's also going to be news, box office predictions, Trailer Park, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456, or you can find me on the web at fatguysatthemovies.com. Facebook.com/FatGuysAtTheMovies, and you can find me on Twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. We're jumping right in the news because we're going to be talking a little bit about casting and development news. Jamie Foxx is apparently going to be playing Mike Tyson, which I think is a good... That's a good fit. I think he can definitely do a Mike Tyson. They'll have to put that gap back in his teeth, which he had in, of course, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. But no, I have perfect faith that Jamie Foxx will be a good Mike Tyson. He's going to have to bulk up a bit, but that's okay. I mean, he's a big enough guy. There's also The Mummy reboot has a new director, Alex Kurtzman, who helped write the Star Trek movies. I think he was supposed to originally do the Venom spinoff, which was supposed to come off The Amazing Spider-Man. But as we learn from news over the last couple weeks, the Amazing Spider-Man sequels are starting to get a little bit questionable about what exactly they're doing. There's the Sinister Six sort of getting retooled. And of course, the Amazing Spider-Man 3 way in the future, you know, several years at least. So we'll see what happens. I think they're trying to retool it for a bigger domestic bang for their buck. Because that international box office is huge right now, but we're in an upswing and you can't completely neglect your American box office, because that sort of newness of 3D and newness of digital projection is going to wane at some point in the international. The thing that's saving Hollywood now is the international box office, but you cannot bank on that from now to the end of time. Quentin Tarantino is in the news for several reasons. One of them, he said he's finally going to be making Hateful Eight, which, of course, you know, forget that little tantrum he had when the script leaked, and he said, I'm not going to make it anymore. That was my Quentin Tarantino impression, by the way. He's going to do it. Apparently, they have a poster out. That doesn't mean anything. I remember back in 2008, there was a poster for Red Sonja at the Comic-Con I saw. That never happened. That movie never even came off the ground. He also says that Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair, is going to be coming to theaters in 2015. Who cares? I mean, it's 10 years old. We've had both movies. Both movies have been on DVD and Blu-ray forever. There might be this interesting little limited release, but I don't know how many people are actually going to plop down like $15 to see these movies that are already on disc and will come out on a full-blown Blu-ray probably within 6 months after that's released. Quentin Tarantino says he's tinkering with a sci-fi thriller in the back of his mind, which I'm assuming is for a 2030 release date sometime in the indeterminate future, with spaghetti western music in space. Forgive me for not having a whole lot of faith in Quentin Tarantino. He makes movies extremely slow, and while they can be good, not all of them are, but the guy just is a scatterbrain dope at times. But he does get some things done, and with Christopher Nolan and J.J. Abrams, this is another news story, they have worked to save Kodak. Kodak is the only producer of film for the movies anymore, and that's because everything's going digital. And they have struck a deal to try and get them to pre-sell film to the studios. Now, this is not going to take care of the distribution. The thing that's really driving digital is the distribution. It's way cheaper to send a hard drive than to send a massive film print, and it takes a lot less expertise to just plug the hard drive in, push a couple buttons, and let it play off a pre-programmed projector than it does to assemble a print and splice it together and get a professional projectionist to actually run it through a projector. Yeah, it's nice that they're saving film. I mean, the film is beautiful, but I really think film's dying. It's not going to come back. And this isn't just, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. This is trying to fix the broken ones. It really doesn't matter. And that's nice. You might stave off the death of film for another 5 or 10 years. And I think there's still value in in having exhibitions of film, you know, movies shown on film in like midnight movies and that sort of thing. I think that's, there's still a value there because that's where the prints exist. And until they can transfer all the existing prints and the existing movies to a digital format and have that disseminated, you need the film presentation format. But for new stuff, it's just, it's gone. It's never going to come back. Sorry, I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news. A couple other things. Remember how last week I told you I was going to do a Comic-Con recap this week? I'm really not, because there's not a whole lot of news, actual hard news that came out of Comic-Con. Most of it were release dates and trailers and posters, stuff that kind of pointless on the radio. You can't see a poster on the radio. And there's some new info on TV shows, but I don't really cover TV. There's not a whole lot of news. A couple little tidbits of news I want to mention, though. They're going to do an Evil Dead TV series with Bruce Campbell. And while a lot of people are like, groovy, I'm questioning whether that's even going to work. I think Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness, that's a great little trilogy. But that took place over 10 or 12 years to make. I don't know if you can make a coherent TV series out of it. You know, where, and is it going to be goofy? Is it going to be Army of Darkness goofy? Or is it going to be realistic like the remake of Evil Dead? I don't know. I don't know if there's enough to actually milk an entire TV series. But what do I know? I thought Fargo was going to be terrible, and it was one of the best series this year. Also, King Kong, Skull Island, the prequel, has been announced with Joe Cornish directing, which I think is great. I loved Attack the Block. I think he can do a really good job. I'm looking forward to it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and that's right, that music means we are moving into the trailer park. Three really quick ones. I don't have time to say much about them, but I'm just going to play them really quick because there's been tons of trailers that have dropped. The first one is Tusk, which is Kevin Smith's new film, a horror movie opening on September 19th.
A walrus saved your life?
The walrus is far more evolved than any man I've ever known.
Why are you doing this?
Are you really mourning your humanity? I don't understand.
This guy wants to turn me into an animal or something.
All I have to say about this movie is Kevin Smith needs to stop smoking weed. I mean, the movie looks interesting, at least from a cinematic standpoint, because it doesn't look like the same old crap cinematography that you get in most Kevin Smith movies. It looks like it's effectively done and artistically done, but it just sounds so stupid. And I'm glad to see him stretch, but this feels like it's fueled by weed again, like everything else he's been doing in his life. So who knows? Maybe. We'll see on September 19th. The next one I want to play, and I've played this a version of this trailer before, an earlier trailer, Interstellar, which opens on November 7th. This is the Christopher Nolan space adventure.
Potentially habitable worlds right within our reach.
Could save us from extinction.
Here we go.
You can't just think about your family. Now you have to think bigger than that.
I'm thinking about my family and millions of other families.
Maybe we've spent too long trying to figure all this out with theory. Love is the one thing that transcends time and space.
I am still not sold on this movie. I know people are just going completely nuts over this on the internet. They're like, oh my gosh, look at this. This is such a great trailer. Oh, isn't it amazing? It's going to be a space epic. It looks boring as all get out. And I'm sure that it's going to have some neat stuff in it, but it just seems like Christopher Nolan is sacrificing, you know, story and things that actually happen for a remake of Contact. There's a lot of hugging and crying and whining and posturing and poetry in this trailer, but I don't know. Maybe it'll be great. I don't know. But it just looks to me like it's like a follow-up to Gravity. And I thought Gravity was so fantastic. It's like Christopher Nolan now stepping in and going, I can do Gravity. Look at my Gravity version. It's like the third trailer. I'm not sold on it. The next one I want to talk about real quick, Mad Max Fury Road. This actually came out of Comic-Con. It opens on May 15th next year.
Water wars.
We are killing for gasoline.
We're getting close to the magical freakout.
Help, help, help the world!
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
Want to get through this?
Let's go!
This is the next Mad Max movie, directed by George Miller, who created the series. He did Happy Feet. It has nothing to do with Road Warrior. I'm looking forward to this. This looks like it's going to have that same excitement and level of octane that the Road Warrior did, which stands out over Mad Max and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And I think Tom Hardy is going to be a worthy follow-up to Mel Gibson. All right, that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about I, Origins and life itself. Kevin Carr coming at you like Mad Max in Fury Road.
That's right.
I feel like a Jags commercial whenever I want to talk about Mad Max. I just feel like I want to, or that guy who was Sunday, come out to the Expo Center for the grandest whatever they were promoting that week. If you ever watched TV in the 80s, that was like those local commercials where they had a little extra time, you know, in the back end of stuff in like late night movies, you know, back when I was a kid. Watching Fritz the Night Owl in Columbus, Ohio, or Big Chuck and Little John on the Cleveland stations. Let's talk about the movies this week, though. First one, these are some smaller films. I like to do smaller films first. Let's ramp up. You know, we'll save the big stuff for next segment. First one I want to talk about is I, Origins. Scientists who research the human eye discover an unexpected link between our own eyes and reincarnation.
I'd like to tell you the story of the eyes that changed this world.
When I saw you, I had the feeling that I had known you. Like we are connected from past lives.
I don't believe in that.
What do you believe in?
I'm a scientist. I believe in proof.
Check this out. There's a girl born in India with Sophie's exact iris pattern.
Impossible.
Maybe the eye really is some kind of window to the soul.
This is directed by the guy who did Another Earth, which came out a couple years ago, also starred Britton Marling. It was one of the worst movies of the year. It was so pretentious and boring and stupid. So I was going in a little bit nervous with this one because I'm like, oh, God. Because the director has a lot to do whether a movie's good or bad. And I'm not surprised after seeing it. It does have that independent, slow burn, somewhat alternative version of a science fiction film feel that Another Earth did. It also stars Britt Marling. No, not stars. Stars is a strong word. She's more a supporting character in this. I'm not a huge fan of Britt Marling. I respect the heck out of her for doing what she does and getting her hands into the writing and the directing and the acting. That's great. I just don't find her all that compelling of an actor. She's sort of like, meh. There's been few movies, maybe like Sound of My Voice, where I said she was really good in that. Everything else, she kind of just seems to be there because she's involved in the production. Not really she's terrible or anything like that. It's just she's kind of boring to me. But she's not the real star. The real star is Michael Pitt, and he plays this guy who's investigating eyes, and he's a scientist who tries to understand eyes. And it really tackles a lot of faith issues. It tackles a lot of it was stuff that we see showing up in the media nowadays between faith and, you know, religion and science. And can they coexist? And can they find a common ground? And is one right and the other wrong completely one way or the other? I think it leaves itself open-ended as much as possible. Very similar to The Sound of My Voice, which dealt with fraud and reality and fantastic elements that maybe could be true. And After Earth tackled the same kind of things, but I think this one does it in a much more effectual, interesting way. Personally, I have a science background, so it always bothers me when there are people who want to shed science from our lives because it conflicts with maybe what they believe. And I'm not here to tell somebody you can't believe in a certain faith, but I'm also here to tell you that science is science, and you can't just turn your nose up at science. I think there needs to be a common ground. I really do. I think the world is, and the universe is greater than what we can fathom. But I also think that shouldn't stand in the way of us trying to fathom the universe, at least what we can in a very rudimentary way, as a very low-level life form. I, Origin tackles some interesting questions, but does it in a very down-to-earth human light. And while it initially feels like it's an anti-faith movie, it's not. It's not an anti-science movie either. I think it offers an open debate, and I think that's fantastic. So I it's a little bit dull at times, and there are times when it starts to really sort of tread water, but each time it happens, the plot throws itself a life preserver, and I'm suddenly interested again. It has 3 or 4 points in there where I'm like, okay, I thought this was over, but this has got a new place to go. So ultimately, I'm going to say I Origins kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about, very close to my heart, Life Itself. This heartfelt documentary examines the life and career of influential Chicago film critic Roger Ebert.
Let's move on to a movie now that's one of the most brilliant, weird, and unusual American documentary films I've seen in a long time.
Roger Ebert was the definitive mainstream film critic in American cinema.
He has been writing for half of the history of feature films.
Roger was a mature writer early on.
He's written over 12 books.
He wrote a novel.
He won a Pulitzer Prize.
How on earth did Roger Ebert write Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Boobs.
I'm running a little late on this one. This one's been out for a while. I actually could have seen it at in Jerusalem when I was in Jerusalem. They were playing it at the film festival. But just due to a schedule of events, I wasn't able to get there. I was so busy with so many things, and there were so many films playing. That was one I just couldn't get to. And I ended up getting a chance to see it when I got back into town. And finally, I'm having a chance to talk about it probably, 2 weeks from when it's going to show up on DVD. But it's worth talking about because not everybody is seeing it. As a documentary, documentaries tend to get low play in the mainstream audience. And if you at all have followed film in the last 40 years, it's worth checking this movie out, because if you followed film at any level, even the most basic level, you could not escape Roger Ebert's presence. He is probably the most influential and important film critic, definitely of the 20th century. And if you look at film critics, there's maybe 5 that are mainstream known. I mean, aside from me, of course, I'm a genius and everybody knows who I am. But I'm talking about, you have Leonard Maltin, Siskel and Ebert, Gene Shalit, maybe Rex Reed, maybe not even now. That's about it. Within any circle, like if you live in New York, you know who Jeffrey Lyons is because he does his reviews there. And if you're in Columbus, Ohio, you are probably aware of who I am and many of my colleagues that are in the Columbus area. Yeah, if you're in Wichita, Kansas, I'm sure there's a film critic in Wichita, Kansas who everybody is at least aware of who they are. But Roger Ebert was known nationally, and he really changed the face of film criticism and really inspired me. I mean, my show is called Fat Guys at the Movies, and At the Movies was one of the iterations of the Siskel and Ebert show. So there's a certain little tip of the hat and an homage to that series. I think what Roger Ebert did was he brought film criticism to the mainstream and made it digestible for people. And even though there's definitely a place for Pauline Kael, and I mean, I know there's a lot of people huge fans of hers, but not everybody needs to write these 5,000 words, renumerations about, film. It's sometimes you can encapsulate it. And Roger Ebert was passionate, and he worked up until he died. And I mean, he struggled through some really rough times in his final years, which they show in brutal honesty and sometimes disturbing imagery, what he had to go through at the end of his life. So Life Itself is a solid documentary. It gives you a lot of history of him, stuff you didn't know. It reveals certain things about the Siskel and Ebert dynamic that maybe not everybody was aware of. It's a fascinating film to watch. And it's sad at times. I think because the movie the production overlapped when he died, there's probably a little more focus on his death and final days than will hold up. I think if you look at this movie 15 years from now, you're going to be realizing that the last third of it is just about him dying. And while I think you don't want it to gloss over that, it becomes this drawn out piece of the last days of his life, which I don't think it needed to be. But that's okay. I mean, I understand how it got there. So Life Itself, if you're at all a fan of films and you've at all read or watched or listened to Roger Ebert, you got to check this movie out. It's definitely worth seeing. So I'm going to give Life Itself a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy and Get On Up. Wow!
Hello,
back to Fat Guys and the Movies, rolling through the blockbuster season. We are officially in August now. And for most years, that would mean blockbusters are over. But this summer was a really soft summer. It was, the biggest movies were from earlier this year. The Lego Movie and Captain America. Those were ones. I mean, there are movies that have done better than them. But those are the ones that were really considered bona fide huge hits. Whereas the ones this summer, I mean, I don't even think, is Transformers going to even make $250 million? It's really playing soft. They're doing fine overseas, but they're really playing soft. And then you had movies like Godzilla, which had a great opening weekend, and then dropped like a stone. So I think we are due for another blockbuster. I think this is like the last ditch effort for a really big summer movie. And spoiler alert, it delivers. We're talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. A ragtag group of space outlaws band together to find an artifact that, in the wrong hands, could bring destruction across the galaxy.
So here we are. A thief, two thugs, an assassin, and a maniac. But we're not going to stand by as evil wipes out the galaxy. I guess we're stuck together. Partners.
Are you telling me the fate of 12 billion people is in the hands of these criminals?
Oh, yeah.
I was nervous when I first heard about this movie because I didn't know if it was going to fit together and work. And then I started seeing stuff come out of it. And everything I saw, from trailers to concept art to deliveries and clips, was just getting me more and more excited about it. And of course, I saw the 17-minute preview about a month ago. And it was an amazing experience. Guardians of the Galaxy is a unique film in the sense that the star is Marvel. The star is not Chris Pratt. I mean, he does a fantastic job. Actually, all the actors are great. You know, Groot, Vin Diesel, it's amazing how much he gets out of I Am Groot. There's a lot that he gets out of that as just a voiceover. Rocket Raccoon, played by Bradley Cooper. It's a talking raccoon, for crying out loud, but the effects are good enough that you believe the character, and he does such a great job bringing a personality to the raccoon that it really works like an interactive character. I mean, we're far ahead of Jar Jar Binks at this point. And Zoe Saldana as Gamora, she's great. And even Dave Bautista, who's not an actor, he's a wrestler, but he's fantastic as Drax. It's an incredibly well-made movie. And I'm not going to get into the nuances of the story, because I will admit the first act is a little bit rough to get through if you're not a huge science fiction fan. There's a lot of stuff going on, and you got to explain how everything works. So you do have to kind of pay attention. But once they get to a certain point where kind of they get together and the Dirty Dozen is going to escape, that is when it works, because ultimately the overall story is they just got to stop this guy from getting the Ark. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark. They got to stop the Nazis from getting the Ark. They've got to stop Ronan from getting the Infinity Stone. That's what it is. And that's what's brilliant about making this movie, is it builds itself on archetypes. Chris Pratt is an amalgamation as Star-Lord or Peter Quill. He's an amalgamation of Luke Skywalker and Han Solo. You watch it, you immediately get that. And he's kind of plays both roles. But you also have Rocket Raccoon as kind of like a cute little fuzzy Han Solo. You got Gamora playing a lethal Princess Leia. You've got Lee Pace playing Ronan. He is Darth Vader. Actually, he's the Emperor. Darth Vader is Karen Gillan as Gamora's half-sister. And then you got Groot and Drax as your Chewbaccas. That's right. This movie has two Chewbaccas. We have two Chewbaccas in this movie, and they both work great. And they balance out really well. You don't feel like, and even though there are two Chewbaccas, they're not getting in each other's way. They each have served their own purpose, and they really fit together in the story. It has some incredible humor. Humor that you have not seen in a Marvel movie outside of Robert Downey Jr.'s delivery as Tony Stark. The Iron Man films have this level of humor, and that's what makes them so good. That's why they are consistently the highest grossing Marvel movies out there. And that's, I think, what makes this fun. Yes, it's got space violence. Yeah, there's things and people that get blown up, but not in a bloody way. So it earns its PG-13 rating simply for being a space adventure, but it is very Star Wars-ish in a space adventure. Historically, studios have been very nervous about science fiction because, with the exception of massive franchises that just happen to go outside the norm like Star Wars, Science fiction franchises are sometimes a tough sell to the mainstream audience. But this, like Star Wars, it works. It's a space adventure. It's very understandable characters. It's not terribly deep, but that's okay. It's a fun movie. It is what popcorn movies are made for. I absolutely loved Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's not just because I'm a sci-fi fan. I would have had fun watching it. It is funny. It is exciting. It looks fantastic. And it, you know, it runs 2 hours. It doesn't over, unlike something like the Transformers movies, which they bloat around over 2.5 hours long. This one's in and out in 2 hours. And yeah, that's a little longer than your average 90-minute film, but that works. It uses that 2 hours and it uses every single piece of it and doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome and it doesn't feel like it rushes out of there. So I'm going to say Guardians of the Galaxy totally rocks. Go check this one out. It is fun.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Next movie I want to talk about on Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr is Get On Up. Chadwick Boseman stars in this biopic of the unique and groundbreaking artist, James Brown.
James Brown!
You blew the roof off the place.
Only you make a record for King.
We breaking new ground every day.
Man's a genius, and he's taking us with him.
You ain't never been down. How you gonna get on up?
I never listened a lot to James Brown, mainly because I'm a white kid from the suburbs. I mean, my biggest introduction to James Brown was watching Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live. I mean, I was born in the early 70s, so I didn't grow up watching Soul Train. I didn't grow up even watching American Bandstand. I watched cartoons and stuff like that. I never got into R&B and soul, but you can't escape the influence of James Brown. So by the time I was old enough to really kind of open my musical horizons, he had kind of been through a lot of his influence in his career through the 60s and into the 70s. But you can't deny what a fantastic musician he was and what a great influence he had on popular music, and not just R&B, but just music in general. And there's a line in the movie where he says, you may not have a James Brown record, but any record you have has my influence in it. And that's absolutely true. But the other thing that's fascinating about this film is it reveals the business end of things. It reveals what he did to protect himself and to protect his band sometimes, and what he did to revolutionize what he did. And he wasn't always nice about it. And they don't mince words. They don't make the film unrealistically soft. You know, they don't flatter him. I mean, they have some pretty unflattering moments in James Brown's career, but that's okay. I mean, I think you don't need a squeaky clean puff piece, and it's not. Chadwick Boseman does a fantastic job. He's, of course, most people know him from playing Jackie Robinson in 42. I think he was also in Draft Day, which wasn't as high profile. But I kind of have to wonder, is Chadwick Boseman trying to make a career out of playing biopics, because this is like his second one in a year and a half. But still, he does a fantastic job as James Brown. I mean, he really becomes a character, and his performance is there, and it's spot on, and it's fantastic. But the best part about Get On Up is its structure. It's directed by Tate Taylor, who did The Help, which is a very straightforward film. And when I went to go see this movie, I was worried, because I'm like, I've seen Ray, I've seen Walk the Line, I've seen, you know, even Jersey Boys this year. The standard biopic of a singer follows a pattern. They come from being poor, and then they get their first hit, and they get starry-eyed, and then they have the rise to fame, and then they have some dark days where they got sideburns and long hair from the 70s, and then they kind of come out of it. You know, it's there's a certain story that every famous musician seems to go through. They don't do that in this movie. They tell it kind of out of order. They break the fourth wall. They hit it with a lot of energy at the beginning. It settles into a regular standard plot about halfway through. But that first half, you don't feel like you're just watching Ray or Walk the Line again. You feel like you're watching a different movie. And that's the key. Because there have been such classic biopics in the last 10, 15 years that you got to do something different. And Tate Taylor did do something different. So I'm going to say Get On Up kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I got to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Boyhood, a little bit of a rant about that, the box office, and the world famous DVD Roundup.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up, get on up, get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a second.
machine. Get on.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, wrapping things up with our final segment. We're going to be talking a little bit about the studio system and how it works today in distributing movies and why it caused me to go on a Twitter rant against IFC Films. This is all about the film Boyhood, which, if you recall, opened like 3 weeks ago. And it's got wide critical acclaim and everybody seems to love it. And I approached the studio through their PR agency. I'm like, hey, can I get a screener of this? Because it's not opening in my market. I live in Columbus, Ohio. It's not opening in Columbus, but I do radio in dozens of states. Can I get a screener? Literally, this is a quote from the PR agency. Unfortunately, we do not have screeners of this title. I understand if it's something like Guardians of the Galaxy, which is a big budget movie and they want it in 3D and an IMAX and it's a big screen movie. You got to see it in the theater. This is Boyhood. This isn't exactly a cinematography feat or anything. It's much more of an intimate character study. I literally had to go to a radio station that asked me, it will remain nameless, but this one host on a radio station in a big market with tens of thousands of people that listen, at least. I don't know what the full numbers are. And he's like, hey, can you review this movie? And I'm like, no, I can't. I had to say it on the air. I had to say, they would not show me this movie. I don't know why. I don't know why they wouldn't show it to me, aside from some stupid archaic rule that it only can be shown if you are in a certain city that's going to be opening, even though I do radio elsewhere. And this is a problem with independent films, smaller films. The studio system used to have wide releases and then it'd have limited releases, and limited release to go city to city to city. And it would really only be relevant for the local press, the people who are in that city, to see the movie before it came out, you know, a week or so in advance. And that made sense when you're publishing a paper or putting something on the radio or television that was only heard or read or seen by anybody in that geographical area. But now you have the internet, so anybody can see a movie and post a review. And somebody like me who does call-ins all across the country, they can't wrap their stupid little brains around that. And it's really annoying. Plus the fact, supposedly, according to our local agency, it opens next week. Well, you know what? I went and I saw it at midnight. Why? Because it's opening at one theater in Columbus. Which is ridiculous that they had a press screening that I couldn't get to because it wasn't fitting in the schedule and it was on the other side of town and the movie's 2 hours and 40 minutes anyways. So I ended up going to the midnight show, which of course put it really, really late. They're sometimes so twisted and backwards in their trying to get people to write about their movie. They want you to support a movie, but not actually see it. When I sent this thing to the press release and the PR agency and I said, hey, and they said, unfortunately, we don't have screeners of this title. It was literally in a response to an email that was like, here's our summer slate of movies. This is what we're repping. Call us or email us with any questions. I did. And they're like, we can't show it to you. Stupid. And for something like IFC Films should know better. Why? Because they're IFC Films. This isn't Disney. This isn't this big, massive conglomerate that's trying to do this massive international release. And it should understand that there's people who do press elsewhere than their city. Anyways, I did end up seeing the movie. So I'm going to give you a real quick review of it. We know we talked about it a couple weeks ago, but I wanted to actually give it a little review. I'm going to replay the trailer right now.
You guys ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
Yeah! Don't worry about it.
Wish we could use the bumpers.
You don't want the bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
Have you been partying?
A little bit.
Oh, okay.
I just want to fight with.
Where do you want to be, Mason? What do you want to do?
Okay, here's the thing. I'm not a big fan of Richard Linklater. I don't like his... I just think he had kind of a depressing life because all of the people in his movies are a-holes. And that's one of my big problems with this film. It's a fascinating experiment, and I respect the filmmaking process a lot. You know, watching this kid grow up from, what, you know, 6 to 18... That's amazing to watch on film. Now, of course, that happened with the Harry Potter movies because they had 7 movies or 8 movies over the course of 10 years or so. And any TV show that happens to have kids in it that lasts more than 5 or 6 years, you see them grow up on screen. So, it's not terribly unique, but it's an ambitious thing to do for one film. The problem with this is while they're going through this kid's life, they really don't characterize the kid until he gets to be about 15 or 16, where he actually has conversations. Otherwise, things are just happening around him. And all the adults in this and all the people in this are jerks. They're not a decent person. And it comes as a problem for me as a parent, because I see a movie like this and it's about kids and it's about parents. And I just look at it and I go, well, they're just terrible parents. They're awful parents. And there's even a point where they're like, oh, you're a good mom. I'm like, no, you're not. Anytime the kid does something wrong or really needs to be corrected, she's like, we'll talk about it later. And I don't think she ever does. And it shows the struggle of, you know, single mom. I mean, and that's fine. The movie does devolve at times into a very Linklater-ish dialogue of sort of these pop psychology nonsense dorm room conversations that people think are oh so deep when really they're stupid. And you get a lot of that in there. And so it does get a lot of Linklater just, you know, putting his political views in there. And of course, then everybody is on drugs because Richard Linklater was a stoner, I think, in high school, because he made a movie about being a stoner in high school. And the people I find that have the whole attitude of everybody does pot are the people who smoke pot because they want to believe everybody does it, but everybody doesn't. And this doesn't represent any world where not everybody's toking up. So it's an unrealistic and very narrow-minded hipster view of boyhood. It's a fascinating experiment. I didn't particularly like the movie. I'm going to actually say, though, it kind of rocks simply before what they're trying to do.
It kind of rocks.
All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk quickly about the box office. Who won, and was I correct? Well, I said that Lucy was going to make $35 million. It actually exceeded expectations. And it did incredibly well. In fact, Lucy made $44 million, just under $44 million, which is fantastic. That's huge numbers. I mean, it's not huge for a July release necessarily, but it's a huge number for a non-sequel. And it just had Scarlett Johansson name-wise behind it, which is really great. And it beat Hercules, which didn't even crack $30 million. It just came in just under that. And what frustrates me about Lucy is there's people saying, well, people are in this big argument whether it's a strong female character or not, or whether she's dumb. Well, so what if it is? You can't have it both ways. I get always frustrated when people say, well, we need movies about women and female, strong female characters, but not this one that did well, that a lot of people liked, because that one's wrong. Now, I can understand if you want to make a case for something like the Twilight films being not good female characters because Bella's a big wimpy wimp who needs a boyfriend and acts like an immature little child. I think you can make a case that way. But you can't sit there and look at Lucy and say, well, just because it's an action film and she's not necessarily dealing with women's issues, that's okay. Look at how many men action stars, male action stars, make a business out of playing just big, dumb action heroes. There's nothing wrong with that. Ultimately, I think it was great that Lucy did well, and there's nothing wrong with having a fun action movie in July. And, you know, good for Scarlett Johansson. She's doing a great career record this year. All right, box office for this weekend. I think Guardians of the Galaxy is going to win. That's a pretty easy bet. How much is going to win? I'm going to go conservative and say $65 million. It's going for the $70 million number because it'd be the first August release to crack $70 million opening weekend. I think it has a chance to do that with the 3D and IMAX bump that it's going to get, plus the front-loaded fanboy reaction. If it did 70 or more, it's huge, but if it's anything under $60 million, it's going to be a bit of a disappointment. But ultimately, it's going to make money because I think it's going to have legs. I don't think there's a whole lot of competition. Yes, there's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and The Expendables in August, but I really don't think those are going to be as strong of competitions. I think those are going to both play as soft as the rest of the summer has been going. Neither of those are going to be big hits. So, Guardians of the Galaxy for the win. And that music means it is time to get into the DVD roundup. All right, this week, it's a pretty thin week. We have Noah, which is, of course, the Ridley Scott, Russell Crowe movie that famously wasn't screened because they were hiding it from critics because they were afraid that it was going to be too secular for the religious audience and too religious for the secular audience. Not a bad movie. Interesting enough. I didn't love it, but it's, like I said, it's an interesting enough movie. There's also The Protector 2, which I covered a couple months ago. Tony Jaa having another smackdown to protect the elephants. This was an okay sort of martial arts action flick. There's Twin Peaks, The Entire Mystery, which includes the entire TV series, plus the Fire Walk With Me movie, which was fascinating to be taken with the TV series, but really it's a bonkers movie and it was impossible to understand if you didn't know anything about the TV series. And it didn't answer anything. It just kind of left out there. It's pure David Lynch. And then Cabin Fever Patient Zero, which I reviewed, oh gosh, about a month ago. And I got an interview with, I think it's Gillian Murray, who was one of the stars of it. You can check that out on the Fat Guys at the Movie site. The stinker of this week is The Other Woman, starring Cameron Diaz, Leslie Mann, and Kate Upton, because it's shrill and annoying and stupid and not very funny. And please, 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 can we stop trying to make Leslie Mann happen? Because she's annoying. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The 100-Foot Journey, Into the Storm, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Step Up, all in. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.